Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
Today's guest is Nassim Haramein, who is the guy behind a documentary that just came out called The Connected Universe about his discoveries. A couple years ago, he opened a lab called Taurus, where he's the executive director of research and development. I've wanted to interview Nassim for quite a while now because I've followed his research online, and he's one of the most original thinkers I've come across. He spent about 30 years researching connections in physics, math, geometry, cosmology, quantum mechanics, biology, chemistry, and even going back to ancient civilizations and looking at some of the different things that they talk about, things even that are in the iconography that you might see carved around the planet that have to do with the actual nature of reality and even like what happens in the womb. So this guy has the ability to put together so many different ideas. And on top of that, he was a pro skier. So just like one of those rare human beings who's probably part alien as far as I can tell. But I absolutely love the way his mind works. And this is an interview I want to do forever. So that is the weirdest introduction I've ever done for the show, Nassim. But
thank you. It's great to be here. And it's Taurus Tech is the lab I see.
Oh, Taurus Tech. It's not just called Taurus. Okay, cool. Yeah. Taurus Tech Labs. Yeah. All right, I got it. All right. Well, let's get into this. You've talked about stuff about the fundamental geometry of space that connects everyone. And you just flat out say everything is connected, which sounds completely, out there, airy-fairy kind of land. But you are not airy-fairy, and that you can back this with hardcore physics and all. What does it mean when you say everything's connected?
Well, it means that there is a relationship between things in which that is a nonlinear relationship. That is, things are connected at a distance, entangled. It's a concept of quantum mechanics that Einstein called spooky action at a distance. And it was discovered early on. I mean, it was predicted by quantum mechanics early on. And then Einstein felt like it was probably incorrect. But eventually it was confirmed in laboratory. And it was found that two particles can be connected at a distance and be instantaneously correlated. That means that if you change one particle over here that's entangled with another one over there, the other one acts just like the one that you're acting upon. So we've been able to entangle two particles. We've been able to entangle multiple ones. And now we've been able to entangle larger objects like diamonds, where if you hit the diamond with the laser over here on this side of the lab, the other side, the diamond on the other side of the lab acts like it's being hit by the laser. And it's instantaneous. It doesn't matter how far the objects are from each other, they are instantaneously act upon when you act on one or the other. And so
this breaks the speed of light, right? Because even though nothing's being transmitted, the action has no delay whatsoever, which is like shocking.
That's
and amazing.
Correct. Right? And it really says something very fundamental about space-time. It was unclear until recently, it's becoming more and more clear, meaning like the observation of the phenomenon was done in laboratory, but there was no actual mechanics to describe how this is happening. And now we're starting to understand it. There's multiple theories out there that are starting to support what I've been saying all along, which is that the particles are connected through wormholes. That is, there's micro wormholes, little teeny filaments that are very, very small, much smaller than an atom, that connects particles together in the structure of space. And you can think of two particles being entangled, but then you can think of particles that are not entangled. And you say, well, if you say everything is connected, what about particles that are not entangled? Well, my equations, which make very important predictions that were confirmed in laboratory now, show that everything is entangled. All the protons are entangled. All the electrons are entangled. It's just that we can only measure the entanglement when we have access to the two particles, the two ends of the wormhole, if you'd like. So, of course, most particles could be entangled with particles that are on the other side of the universe through wormhole networks, and we wouldn't know. Meaning when we move this particle over here, we don't realize there's another one on the other side of the universe that's moving, right, that's entangled with it. So we think that there's some particles that are entangled and some that are not, when in fact they all are entangled. And when we consider particles that way, when we do the mathematics I did to like basically figure out what is the influence of all the other particles on one particle, we find very fundamental values like the size of the particle, the mass of the particle, the forces that particle applies on other particles, and so on. And it's extremely precise. And it has been confirmed by laboratories, so it's pretty exciting.
Now, even the existence of wormholes is something that, certainly if you watch Star Trek or read science fiction, we all want there to be wormholes. And I mean, do we have proof that such a thing exists?
Well, we don't directly. They're part of the consequences of Einstein field equations. Einstein field equations are confirmed by many, 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 many different experimental results and observation. So if, you know, it is a consequence of Einstein field equation and we've confirmed those equations, then there's a good chance that they exist. Now, as I was saying, though, we're starting to discover that particles are entangled by, micro wormhole, and that might be actually the closest thing we have to confirming the existence of wormholes.
So you've done some math and I think published some new equations, some new theories that hint at the existence of these wormholes based on observable things. But so far, we don't know how to measure a wormhole. But you've moved us a step closer to at least a plausible, scientifically backed theory that these things exist.
Yes, and as well, it leads to an engineering path on how to be able to open the mouth of a wormhole, which could be very, very interesting for space travel.
Now, this is why I love having you on here, because we are already living in science fiction. If you 25 years ago read Snow Crash, like we're ridiculously closer and closer to a lot of these, you know, the cyberspace, right, and things like that. And it's shocking because this is happening, right, in our lifetime. I don't know that I'm not saying we're going to open wormholes to outer space in our lifetime, but if you can make a microscopic one that leads to a path that says maybe it can be bigger.
Well, now I would tend to disagree with you. I think we're gonna open wormholes in our lifetime. I think we're really, really close, and actually.
Big ones, like for space travel in our lifetime.
Warp space time.
Yes, you're making me happy.
You know, I think we're really close. I mean, there's large efforts from NASA to do so. It's not just, bleeding edge scientists like I that are out there trying to do this. There's more and more interest from the mainstream. It is not so esoteric. It is predicted by standard equations. It's just not being clear using standard equations how you would be able to open them. And that's where, more advanced physics that are being published now are starting to give us a path on how it's done. Because there's an energy that's present in the structure of space-time that was not accounted for in earlier equations.
I will disclose something I don't think I've talked about on the show before. One of my uncles was an early tech entrepreneur in the data center space and made a ton of money and went off and decided he would take his newfound wealth and study the effect that made capacitors jump off of high energy laser boards, and ended up coming up to something that was in the same field as you. And he basically said this has to do with, you know, Planck's constants, and basically there is energy that we're tapping into. And he had mathematical proof that said, look, you can move things with propulsion using just the electricity.
Wow, I'd love to read his work.
Okay. I have it. I actually sent it to the guys working on SpaceX, believe it or not. Not Bird Rutan. The other guy doing the math. Anyway, I'll think of who it is. But I'll happily send that to you because... he passed unexpectedly 20 years ago. I was one of the early guys investing in private exploration of space before SpaceX, before Peter Diamandis and all that. But so like this kind of stuff runs in my family. My grandmother's a PhD nuclear engineer. So I'm not a physicist. I'm not a quantum physicist. I'm a computer science guy. But I know that every time I read your stuff, I'm like, wow, like I know that there's meat on that bone that science hasn't necessarily, at least much of science hasn't gotten to. I also know we have a huge number of scientists and academics and a lot of medical people. And what we're running into is that the quantum effects at the subcellular level, at the mitochondrial thing, when you have a semiconductive mitochondria, that's probably quantum entangled. You got all kinds of cool stuff going on. So I want to talk about like going to space in wormholes, which is the coolest thing I've ever heard of. And then I want us to zoom in on this microscopic stuff and how that may be affecting our consciousness. And I know you look at these and very few people will go the whole spectrum there. So let's start in space and end up in inner space. Sound like
a
plan?
Well, I think they're connected. That's the thing. If you take my equations for the radius of the proton, which is still to this day the most precise prediction of the nuclei of an atom, right? The proton nuclei of an atom in history, meaning, you know, the standard model is off by 4% according to the latest measurements. My results is within the margin of error of the experiment, which is within 0.00036 of the experiment. So Just to give an idea of comparison, in some three decades of string theory with billions of dollars invested, thousands of physicists working on it, not one prediction came out of string theory, which is the competing theory for unification. My theory has produced many predictions, but certainly that's one. The radius, the proton, is very important. In any case, when I made these equations, when I rendered these equations, which are remarkably simple, I mean, the complexity I went to find the equation is ridiculous, but the actual result is so simple, it's remarkable. When you actually render those equations, you're using the mass of all the other protons in the universe. That is, you're using the mass of the universe in the equation to output the mass of one proton. So basically what it's saying is that all the information of all other things in the universe are present in one proton, in one point in space. And the relationship of all that information enclosed in the volume of a proton, which would make the proton a mini black hole, relative to the surface, the amount of information that's able to escape the proton, gives the exact mass and radius of that proton in these equations exactly correct. That is, so it's basically saying that mass energy is really the transfer of information across the entangled network of space-time through these micro wormholes. And so when I say the outer world and the inner world are entangled, I really mean it. I don't mean it in a completely esoteric way. I mean it in a physical way. That is, the proton or the electron, the source of matter, is literally the relationship between the outside and the inside, making boundaries.
So there you go. That's probably the most the most effective way to say everything is connected. The protons in every one of your cells are a reflection of the mass of the entire universe itself, which is okay. Pretty cool. And that does dial us right into the inner space thing. I got to ask, What's your educational background? Because you literally are doing real work on ancient civilizations and the stuff they've said. You're like, oh, that looks a lot like the work I'm doing. And then you flip over. So like, how did you get to have a brain like this?
Well, I took a very strange path through the educational system. I was actually a high school dropout. And I, you know, was involved in the ski industry for some 20 years. I became very proficient. I was one of the top 20 ski instructor in Canada and coach. I was very involved in the sport industry, but all along I was asking very fundamental questions about the source of reality and the structure of space-time. I was very interested, and it was a hobby, and I did. I studied for a long period of time as a hobby, and then some 30 years ago, I gave up the ski industry, and or some 25 years ago, I gave up the ski industry, and I started to actually work full time in studying physics and mathematics, and as you mentioned, ancient civilization, because as I did my study, I kept on finding strange relationship between ancient symbols and some of the geometry of space that I was rendering in the physics I was writing. And so I was able to study independently all through this time, a lot like many others, you know, that are known, some of them not as known, but one of them being Einstein, you know, and I did, you know, Faraday was another. I did, you know, the best I could in being able to access material using universities and libraries and, you know, talking to other physicists and so on. And then eventually I studied enough that I was able to, like, start to put the pieces together. And because I wasn't confined to a certain, you know, a certain doctrine, a certain set of thoughts, I didn't have, you know, class duties. I didn't have, you know, to teach in universities or anything. So I was able to, like, completely immerse myself and concentrate, because working on unification theory is very difficult. And usually physicists only do it when they're in their 70s or 80s, because it takes that long to study enough of the field to be able to start to put the pieces together. It typically, when you study in physics, you study something very specific and very narrow, and you don't, you know, and in order to unify the field, of course, you have to study much wider range of physics, because you have to try to unify the pieces. And so I was able to do that from the start.
How has the traditional field of physics responded to your equations that actually are better predictive than the ones you had before?
They've been pretty positive, but it's been a long journey. You know, I get a lot of critic out there, but in general, the critics you see out there on the net, they're not physicists. They're bloggers that actually don't quite understand what I'm doing. You won't see out there like well-established physicists criticizing my work that much, because the math is the math is the math, and it adds up. And so, you know, in fact, if you look on our website, you'll see physicists that are praising my work. It's not obvious, however, for the physics community to endorse my work. It's very difficult for me to publish as an independent. It's difficult for me to get appropriate citing from other physicists because the establishment is not so excited about my work. The institutions is more of the issue. Of course, the institutions are funded, like large laboratory accelerators and all this, are funded based on the standard model. If all of a sudden the standard model is no longer appropriate, you know, it threatens their funding source and so on. So it's been a long journey. For instance, I was invited to give talks on my work after I made the prediction of the proton radius that became confirmed. Right away, I was invited to give a talk at CERN, one of the largest accelerators. The director at the time canceled my talk promptly, and so on. So it's difficult. It's been a long journey. It's a battle. It's normal. You expect that. You know, people are not, when they spend their whole life studying a certain way, they don't necessarily give it up overnight. But it's making its way. And there is changes, very fundamental changes that are occurring in the understanding of quantum mechanics and quantum physics that are really taking hold now. Like the Copenhagen interpretation is becoming less and less popular.
What? I don't think most people listening know the Copenhagen interpretation. Can you dumb that down for me?
I don't know it. What you wanted to talk about as well with some of the things about consciousness, but at the foundation of modern quantum mechanics is a interpretation that was given to the double slit experiment. The double slit experiment is an experiment where you're shooting particles at a slit. And there's a detector board behind it. And you're looking at what the pattern that the particle makes on the board. And so if this is one slit, you see the particle hit the board behind it. You see dots on the board. If there's two slits, however, it seems like you get an interference pattern in the back on the board behind the slits. And so the interpretation for that was very esoteric at the time. That is, it was not understood how the particle could somehow interfere with itself and produce an interference pattern if you had two slits. And so it was like this very esoteric approach was brought forward by a bunch of different physicists, mostly German ones. Einstein didn't agree with this interpretation, but he went with it eventually. It was the idea that that the particle could be a particle and a wave at the same time, and it could interfere with itself, that it could be in state of superposition, that is, it could be in going through both slits at the same time and interfere with itself and so on. And then it was found that if you put an instrument to try to pinpoint exactly which slit the particle was going through, you got a third result again. And then that's where the concept that the observer actually changed the result of the experiment. And that all got extremely esoteric. And actually all mechanical models of particle physics were kind of abandoned at the time. And it was reverted to conceptual math with statistical, basically conceptual physics without mechanics became the base of modern quantum theory. And I always disagreed with that. Einstein disagreed with it till the end of his life. He tried to find a better solution, actually literally till the day he died. Like the day he died, he was working on those equations. But he was not able to find a solution. One of the things that are becoming more and more prominent now is that there's a different interpretation that can be given. And that is that when the particle is moving, it's not moving in a field-free environment. It's moving in a field. It's called a quantum vacuum. And in that field, when you move a particle, it makes waves. So, of course, it's a particle and a wave at the same time, just like a boat is a boat that on the ocean makes waves as it moves, right? So you can think of it that way. So when you have one slit, the boat goes through. When you have two slit, the boat goes through and the wave goes through the other and interferes with it. So all of a sudden it becomes mechanical again. It's fluid dynamics. So eventually, and so I came up with that independently, not realizing it had been found by de Broglie a long time ago and Bohm. Eventually, you know, laboratories tried to put silicone beads on silicone fluid and vibrate the fluid and then shoot the beads, and they got all the same result as the double slit experiments, called the pilot wave theory. And pilot wave theory is gaining a lot of support now because there's experiments supporting it, and you can get pretty well everything you find with the double slit experiment using this approach.
One of the interpretations that you'll see in fields of consciousness and personal development, a lot of people misuse, you know, quantum, you know, quantum yogurt at the store at this point, whatever that means. But one of the things about the observer effect is that, you know, a wave won't necessarily collapse into a particle without something observing it.
The current interpretation given by the spiritual community about, or the consciousness, you know, community about the Copenhagen interpretation is incorrect. Meaning, when the Copenhagen interpretation talks about the observer, they are not talking about a human being. They're talking about a measurement.
Yes.
And that measurement can be done by a computer with no human being around. Like it's not directly related to consciousness, and that leap is done by people that don't quite understand the mathematics that are being involved in this computation, and so it's incorrect, and that's why the mainstream doesn't look at it favorably implying that consciousness is involved, because it doesn't mean. There's nothing in the equation that says anything about consciousness there. It just says a measurement has to be made.
I've done a lot of work on the biological level, looking at the smallest and first measurement device in the mm-hmm. human body, and came to the conclusion that it's your mitochondria, these ancient bacteria inside your cells, because they are sensing the environment way before your eyes roll that signal up through a multi-tiered mm-hmm. system inside the body. And so my interpretation of this, which is not math-based, it's consciousness-based, is that you have pattern-matching systems throughout the body that are consistently trying to measure and make sense of the world around you. And by the time you become aware of it, it's already been in there for some amount of time, some meaningful amount of time, you know, 10,000th of a second or something like that. And what that means is that if you can change the way you train your system to look at reality, you can probably have a better awareness of it, but maybe you can even use some of these effects to just change the world around you just by being more aware of it. And being, you know, less you know, looking for disaster, maybe looking for abundance, you might actually find it, and you might actually influence it. I can't prove you can influence it; just makes sense given what I've seen. Well, do you buy that?
I mean, you know, that's the thing is that, you know, this tendency to hold on to the Copenhagen interpretation to try to explain consciousness is inappropriate, first of all, because, But as well, you know, what's not clear to people is that actually, you know, the Copenhagen interpretation and the Schrodinger equations, which is typically described as the Schrodinger cat, you know, the cat that's in the box and you don't know if it's alive or dead, you know, until you open the box, the quantum waveform doesn't collapse into a live or dead cat, right? Well, what I'm saying here is that the universe is never confused about the state of the cat because it doesn't need a human to observe it. It's not because it's in a box that it's isolated from the rest of the universe. For instance, what about the frame of reference of the flea that's on the cat? The flea will know if the cat's alive or dead. You know, what about the microbes inside the box? This leads to what you're talking about. So imagine that was the wrong interpretation. Imagine it's pilot wave theory. Imagine the particle, when it's moving in a field, but this is a field of information. And this is actually how I wrote these equations. Quantum field theory predicts that space and time, space is not empty at the quantum level. It's full of information. It's full of energy. And And that is the source, according to what I found, is the source of the material world. It's that energy organizing itself into particles. So all of a sudden, imagine that, like when you go back to consciousness study, imagine that you're producing consciousness inside of you. Imagine that you're like an antenna tapping into a field of information, right? And now you're not only receiving like a radio set, but you're sending like a transceiver. So you're sending information, you're receiving information. So now you start to get a really good sense that yes, you can influence the field. Depending on what you're sending in is what you're going to get back, because that's how you're tuning the antenna. You have beautiful antique radio sets behind you, you know.
Yeah, for a reason.
Exactly. And so those used to be tuned with a crystal oscillating, right? And so the crystal had to be tuned exactly at the right frequency, and all of a sudden you'd hear the music, right? The band is not in the box. The band is not playing in the box. The box is connecting to a field, an electromagnetic field, you know, radio waves that are interacting with the box, and then you're getting the music out. Well, think about consciousness in the same way. All of a sudden, and I wrote my first papers in biophysics talking about this, and they were published at Quantum Neurology Journal a year ago or so. So I'm pretty excited. It's my first papers in biophysics. I usually only write papers in physics. And we were talking about this possibility that your whole body with your brain being like the nervous system central of the antenna, and then your state of emotions, we don't put that in the paper, but this is what's implied, would be what tunes the antenna, because we know that's the dial on the radio set, because we know that when you change your state of emotion, it changes the chemicals, it changes the biorhythm, it changes everything, which is what's tuning the antenna to a frequency or to another one.
That would also imply that you could increase the power and modify the structure of the antenna.
That's
to work
right.
Better.
You exactly.
And that would be biohacking, right? A field that I wrote the definition of, which is that when you make your cells work better, you are better able to experience the world around you,
right,
and change it.
Yeah,
you buy that?
Absolutely.
Like, I'm. It's okay to say no, but I'm just kind of checking in with a guy who's done a lot deeper and more precise work.
I think that's
right.
Very good. I call it vacuum engineering, because you're engineering the structure of the Planck vacuum or the quantum vacuum, and I totally agree. And basically, you can tune the antenna to a higher resolution of information or lower, right? It's like if you have the dial a little bit off on your radio, there's a lot of noise. If you nail the frequency, then you get lots of clarity. I think you're absolutely right. And it will have to do with, you know, your state of health, your state of emotion, you know, the way you're interpreting the field around you. You're literally, you know, basically a machine interpreting the field and sending your interpretation back into the field. And the field is feeding you back the information in terms of your reality around you and the experiences that you have. So you are engineering your reality as you're going along, if all this is correct. And like I said, it's not just philosophy. At this point, it's very much founded on solid evidence that this is actually how atoms and all of reality is produced.
Do you believe, therefore, that consciousness is outside the body?
No, because the quantum field structure is inside the body as well. Atoms are 99.9999999% space. So, you know, when I'm talking about space or the structure of space or space-time or the quantum vacuum, I'm talking about the inner space as much as the outer space. because we were basically made out of mostly space. And the 0.0000001% that we call the material structure of our body or anything around us is actually just an electrostatic field that defines boundaries in space. So this is what led me to write these equations a little bit differently than the standard model. I realized that when we're talking about a particle, we're not talking about a little billiard ball. We're actually talking about a little boundary in the structure of space. And it's just an electrostatic boundary. That's why, for instance, the radius of the proton is called the charge radius of the proton. It's because all we can say about that particle is that there's a charge in that region of space, a high positive charge we call the proton. But we're not seeing a thing down there. We're just seeing a charge in that region of space. And so it's important for people to realize matter is not some solid thing. It's just a bunch of fields interacting in space.
So are you concerned then about some of the things that we're doing with something as simple as Wi-Fi radios we've had for 100 years or thereabouts, however long we've been doing radio, these other things that are creating new fields that don't exist or that didn't exist historically? Is that messing with things in a way that we haven't predicted?
It does have an influence. I'm actually quite amazed at how resilient, the body is being exposed to that much electromagnetic interference continuously during the day. So I think the state of health of some of the stuff we're doing is really counterindicative. I think as well, the body has this incredible resilience, incredible capacity to overcome interference, meaning you have 100 trillion cell, which is a non-trivial number. There's between 100 and 1,000 billion chemical change every second occurring in these 100 trillion cells in order for them to cohere and keep doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. There's millions and millions of cell divisions every second to replace all the cells that die. Everything. So it's a fairly powerful Carnot engine. It's burning almost at 100 degree Fahrenheit continuously throughout 24 hours a day throughout 100 years lifetime. It's a remarkable, very dynamic, very energetic system. And so, I think certainly earlier electromagnetic devices were more damageable than the later ones, because we're able to go to a higher frequency and lower energy level to get the job done. And so it's not as bad. For instance, when radio sets, when the first cordless came out, they were 900 kilohertz, and it was it was a bad wavelength, relative to the size of the cranial cavity and so on. It had more chance to interact with biology and so on. So things actually improving at that level. I think it's getting better, but now we have microwave we're putting to our ear all the time with our cell phones and so on. That's why I always recommend using headphones or using a speakerphone and keeping your cell phone away from your body. But definitely, I'm sure it has some influence. It's hard to quantify it.
It is hard to quantify it. I found that where I keep my cell phone, I don't keep it near my reproductive organs because there's good evidence for that. But where I keep it on my right thigh, I had 10% less bone density right where the phone is. So it's definitely having an effect, and there's some biochemistry that explains that with calcium channels and things. But I always wonder, just from a conscious level, if we really are a collection of electrostatic fields and other types of fields, whether unconsciously introducing new perturbations in all those fields is really doing good things for our consciousness apart from our biology. I'm not saying yes or no. I just wonder, and was thinking you might have done some thinking.
I have, as well. And you know, I think as well there's a morphogenetic field that connects us. You know that.
What's that?
Well, this work that was done by Rupert Sheldrake that showed that that we're not individualized, that there is that actually we're participating in a field very similar to what I found, but that he came to it from biology, because that being his field. He's a professor in a university in England, and he came to the idea that like all biological entities, all structures on the surface of the planet are interacting with this fundamental field that connects everything and that gathers information and that can be influenced. Some of the evidence for that field have been supported by experiments. That is, some of the experiments where they're measuring the effect of human behavior, or at least some behavior in biology that influence random generators. So, you know, where they have random generators around the world, they're called eggs, and they're connected to a network. And when, and all this data feeds back to Stanford at one point, and they can see that when they noticed early on, first of all, that when there was a big fada at one point, you know, a big fashion to have global meditations. I don't know if you remember those years, yep. You know, in the late yeah. 80s, early 90s, and so on, like probably till about 2000, there was a lot of global meditation where there would be, you'd be email, huge email list, and everybody would meditate at the same time. They noticed that the random generators would start to go non-random. They would start to output non-trivial, non-random, output relationships in the network. And then the more dramatic data came when 911 occurred, where literally every hit of the planes on the tower showed very non-random result on the random generators around the world. Since then, they've done other studies showing that a person sitting in front of a random generator computer can influence it, and so on. So basically, we seem to be participating in this field I was describing earlier. And
your work is helping to define that field more correct. Tightly. And so these are small examples of things that should not be correct. Possible if the traditional things that we believe are out there. And we have this inherent bias as humans to say, that cannot be given what I know, therefore it isn't, even if you're staring at the data right. in the face.
It's hard for scientists to necessarily endure, you know, like feel comfortable with this kind of data, because it goes against so much of our senses that are fairly limited. So we think you're there and I'm here, and there's no way we're connected in some way. But at the end of the day, it seems like we are. And just because of entanglement at the quantum level. And, you know, when you look at nature, you can definitely see that nature has very fundamental relationship dependencies. And if it didn't, nothing would work. And this is really the part that's missing in physics. If you want to get to the source of it, this is the part that's missing in physics. There's nothing in standard physics that can predict a human being. There's nothing in standard physics that can predict even a microbe. forget a human being, or even just a monocellular structure is too complex to emerge out of the current physics we've written, because they all are based on the concept that the universe is random. And if the universe is random, the complexity of biology cannot emerge from it. It's the probabilities are like extremely low. And when I mean extreme, I mean extreme, you know, 10 to the 8,896 from our calculations, for even just the most simplest, interaction to produce the first monocellular structure. So the probability of that happening is almost zero. And so it's got to be something different. And the reason why scientists really don't want to go there is because then they start thinking, oh, he's going to say God is doing something, or there's some deity that's, you know, organizing the universe and all this. And I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's feedback into a field of information. Right. That's all you need for organization. As soon as you have feedback, then things can organize very, very rapidly, and the math all start to make sense again. Otherwise, it doesn't.
So you're proposing the existence, well, other people propose, but you're supporting the existence of a field that supports feedback, which allows life to form and allows all these small things we keep noticing that appear to be non-random and actually are non-random because of the existence
of the field. Right, exactly. Like there's no way under random function that all of a sudden 100 trillion cells arrange themselves into a human being. And not only does it do it initially, it continues to do it every second and continues to do the right thing, just by bumping into each other randomly. Absolutely not. You know, so there's something much more advanced, much more complex going on. And remarkably, from feedback, you can get all that complexity very, very rapidly. And maybe people would like to know what I mean by feedback. Think of a fractal equation. A fractal equation is an equation where you have a simple set of rules that defines a very specific geometry. And basically, you take the answer and you feed it back to the equation. It's called iteration. And then you do more and more iteration. Well, very rapidly, if you've ever seen fractal graphics, very rapidly, you get very high level of complexity, very high level of order, and with very few iterations. And currently, for instance, in CGI, when we do animations in Hollywood with some of the most advanced animators in the world, what do they use? They use these fractal equations to make natural objects. Like if they're trying to make a tree, if they're trying to make water ripples, if they're trying to whatever they're trying to animate that's natural, they use fractal equations to get that, because they produce very similar structures that you see in nature. So that should tell you something, because those equations are feedback equations. So a good example on how feedback can create order out of randomness very quickly is the example given by Sir Doyle about a Rubik's Cube. So if you actually take a Rubik's Cube and give it to a blind person, which is really a mean thing to do, but and you ask them to order it, and let's say they can move every second, you can calculate what are the probability of them ordering the cube randomly. And the probability are staggering, meaning they're quadrillions in probability. So if they're making a move every second, the probability of them ordering the cube randomly exceeds the time since the 13.7 billion years start of our universe by billions and billions and billions of years. You're talking 100 billion years and more. And so the probability of them all of a sudden just ordering the cube randomly is very low. And the Rubik's Cube is much simpler than a human body. But if you tell that person just one little piece of binary feedback, like, yes, you're getting closer, or no, you're getting further. Every time they make a move, within 2.5 minutes, they will have the Rubik's Cube ordered. So that's just with like a yes or no, every move, if they're moving every second. So that is remarkably different how fast you get order out of feedback compared to random functions.
And for people listening, I would propose that one of the simplest feedback systems in existence is called meditation. Yeah. For you, right? So it's how am I doing right now? Noticing that and then putting it back into your own system, which is why meditation has gone over the last 20 years from something that only crazy hippies would do to something that the highest performing people on the planet do regularly. And things like feedback on your heart rate variability, which is a core biohacking technology, neurofeedback, showing your brain what it's doing, feeding it back into the brain and allowing it to amplify what it's doing. So feedback is fundamental to life, is what you're saying, and fundamental to
reality as a whole. Basically, the equations I wrote say that it is the universe feeding back on itself that produce the material world, like the atoms, the protons, the electrons. And I solve for the electrons for the whole table of elements using those equations as well. So actually, the whole thing is the universe learning about itself, and you're part of it. You know, you're kind of like a universal, you know, probe out there learning and feeding back to the universe your interpretation of the field. It's remarkable.
It's also remarkable because we finally reached the age of artificial intelligence. And I actually studied this in my undergrad degree. I have a concentration in a field called decision support systems. We weren't allowed to call it artificial intelligence because no one ever thought artificial intelligence would become real. But what we're doing with these neural networks you hear about, the things that are powering Siri and powering Google, all it is basic stuff where they feed back the results of what they did back into the system, which is the same thing our prefrontal cortex does in the brain. It's got 6 layers and each one feeds back onto the next layer. So like feedback is built into our biology. It's built into the world around us. It's built into the smartest systems. It's built into computer generated graphics. And one of the ways you perform better as a human being is becoming better at receiving feedback from yourself. We call that awareness, at least in my view of the world. That matches
yours. Absolutely. And you know, and so you can think, okay, so now let's go into a very advanced view of space travel. You know, so imagine now that let's imagine that you're trying to calculate this might sound really esoteric, but think about it. It's actually something you do every day, like that your car, for instance, does for you every day. You calculate the velocity of the car from point A to point B, or your hand leaving point A and going to point B, right? So you might say my hand leaves point A at this time and arrives at point B at this time. And so according to that period, you know, the velocity of my hand must have been da 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 da, right? For that distance. But is this true? No, it's not. You've done an approximation of the movement of your hand in space based on isolating your frame of reference to your hand, meaning assuming that the universe frame of reference is yours, but the universe frame of reference is not yours. That is, if you actually look at the universe frame of reference, while your hand was moving from point A to point B, the Earth is spinning, and then the Earth is, you know, so you have to add that because your hand actually moved through space during that time. And then you have to add the fact that the Earth is spinning around the sun, and that the sun is going at 300 kilometers per second in the galaxy. And, you know, the galaxy is spinning itself. And then inside the cluster, inside the supercluster, inside the universe, assuming our universe is in the multiverse, then that most likely is moving as well. And so on. And eventually you get to your hand is moving at the speed of light. So then what is your hand doing and what exactly is movement? And then you start to realize maybe movement is actually not what we think, but it's quantized. Maybe actually movement is quantized in such a way that my hand leaves A by becoming the field, the whole, and then collapsing back into my hand a little bit beside it because I changed the information in the field by intending to move my hand. And then it collapses again into the field and back to my hand a little bit beside it and beside it, and like frames of a movie, when they're fast enough, when they're moving fast enough, it looks smooth, but it's actually quantized. And so then you would say, well, okay, at what speed is these frames, you know, occurring? They would be occurring at the Planck time, which is very, very, very fast, right? But if you could tap into the Planck time, if what I'm saying to you is, if you tap into that wormhole network at the Planck scale of that field, all of a sudden you could say, but I want my hand to start at B, but I don't want to transfer the information to the Planck particle just beside it. I want to transfer it to the Planck particle on the other side of the universe. And then my hand would, instead of being redone just beside it, it would be redone on the other side of the universe, so that I could collapse my field over here of information and then uncollapse it on the other side of the universe.
If that sounds really weird for people listening, we've all seen the movie Dune or read the books. That's what the spice was all about. And there's a fascinating new book in neuroscience called On Intelligence. And I find some of the most interesting work is done by people outside of a field. This is a book written by the guy who invented the Palm Pilot. This is the first handheld device before we had smartphones. I worked at the company that acquired them when they were a tiny startup before the Palm Pilot became anything big. And the book is called On Intelligence, but he argues very convincingly that the structure of the brain itself is where the way you move your hand or do anything else is you predict the future. And he describes this in neurological terms, like inside brain structures, and that as you predict the future, you move your hand into where it's going to be in the future in multiple steps, using feedback from each layer of the body, starting very low, moving up into the brain. So this stuff is fascinating. I'm not sure, though, if people are listening to this right now and they've been following it, what are the implications for what we could do to use this in our lives today?
Well, I think certainly the implication is that we have to pay a lot of attention, a lot more attention to what's going on inside of us, how we're interpreting the field. Yeah. You know, what are we, if we're transceivers, what are we sending for signals into the universe? And what is the universe feeding back to us in our lives, you know? And so how we interpret the field is critical. So certainly, like on the day-to-day base, spending a little time every day, like meditation or yoga, whatever, to actually pay attention to what's going on internally to us, not just the external world, but the internal, I think is critical. Of course, what I'm talking about has significant technological application. If this field of information is there, it's extremely dense. It's been measured now directly by multiple laboratories. We know it's there. If we are able to tap into it, you know, in terms of energy that could provide all the energy the world will ever need, directly out of the structure of space-time, you know, for space travel, as I was talking about, it can change everything. Certainly could give us gravity control, the capacity to control gravity and so on. But so, and that will change dramatically people's life, you know, their daily life. But certainly, you know, paying attention to what we think and how we feel and where we're at and how, what are we feeding the world? What are we feeding the field in every minute of our day? And I think if we spend a little time, even just 5 minutes every day, just connecting and finding our center, and then moving from there during the day, I think that it can have a dramatic positive impact in our lives.
Very, very well said. If you walk around all day full of hate and smiling, it doesn't work because you're sending that out into the world. And I fundamentally believe that we're wired to be kind to each other, and that what's going on in your heart, in your body, in your mind at all times affects the world around you in a subtle way. It's not, you know, like you're going to catch on fire right now. I've definitely made that part of my practice where I'm just not going to walk around thinking ill of other people, even if I believe that they've wronged me, just because it's not a good thing. It doesn't feel good. And if this information field exists, which I believe it does, and the math supports that it does, then don't crap in it. It's like you wouldn't poop in your water supply. So when you're putting bad stuff out into the world around you, it is a form of pollution.
And really our society as a whole has been doing that, you know, and hopefully we're starting to learn that lesson that we can't pollute our own waters and destroy our trees and all this and assume that we're going to survive it. So absolutely it is critical that we are able to maintain, you know, it's like this. If you're going to be walking around hating, you know, the universe is going to respond to you with that level of intensity as well, that kind of energy, that kind, you're tuning into that radio station, and it probably is not the best music you want to be listening to. And really at the beginning, you know, it's almost just becoming aware that there's something in there that's constantly yapping, you know, and then what is it saying?
Yeah.
Because we're not necessarily aware that this is happening inside of us. It's like, we got accustomed to having this thing yapping inside of us. People call it the mind, you know, and it's not necessarily saying nice things. It's not necessarily saying supportive things, constructive things about yourself. You know, people are so harsh judging themselves, you know, so commonly, and that leads to judging others, right? And so on. And so really it has to do with like becoming aware of the internal dialogue that's going on, basically the information that you're tapping into, and then changing the radio station.
Very well described. And that leads us right into another passion of yours, which is these ancient cultures. And almost every ancient culture has some form of meditation, some form of mindfulness. Lots of, in some traditions, like the shamanic traditions, there's psychedelics. Other ones, you know, meditating in caves and fasting and things like that. I've interviewed Graham Hancock, who's done research on, you know, civilizations from before 10,000 years ago and things like that. What of your work, what of your work have you found replicated in the ancient technologies or ancient civilizations that you've looked at? Like kind of draw the connections.
Okay, so this might sound really wild for people, but I just I just spent, for instance, a month in Egypt, going through the temples and the ancient, you know, various structures that are found there. And the evidence is staggering. I know that like people don't believe this, but the evidence is staggering that there was an advanced civilization on our planet long prior to the dynastic Egypt, long prior to the Mayan, the Incas, the Aztec, and all, you know, the earlier civilization that left very advanced knowledge and you know remains on our planet in many places, things that cannot be reproduced today. You know, like I'm standing there at the Valley Temple, right below, you know, the Giza Plateau, right beside the Sphinx, and you're looking at 200 ton blocks. Those are non-trivial size. You know, like you're not that big beside a 200 ton block. and they're stacked on top of each other. Then these were covered with granite blocks, pink granite from Aswan, which comes from almost 1,000 kilometers away, and perfectly, you know, these granite slabs that covered these huge blocks were perfectly arranged so that even today you can't put a razor blade between them. In some cases, you can barely see the joint between them. It disappears. You have to zoom in with a camera to actually see where the two blocks join. The erosion on some of these blocks is remarkably high, very, very high. And geologists are saying this cannot be dynastic Egypt. It had to predate dynastic Egypt by thousands and thousands of years. The earlier estimates, they go all the way to 80,000 years, you know, than the more conservative ones, around 12,000 to 11,000 years. But certainly prior to the last ice age, to the meltdown of the ice age and so on. And that's what Graham Hancock has found as well. All around the world, not just in Egypt, you have statues in Egypt that weighs over 1,000 tons of granite, pink granite, that was taken from a quarry across the Nile, hundreds of kilometers to where it was found. We don't lift that today. We don't run around with it. We don't roll it around. We don't, nothing like that happens in modern history. And the things are carved perfectly. And then people are going to say, well, why does it say Ramses II on it? Well, that's because it's well known that dynastic Egypt kings went around and put their name on everything they found that was, remarkable or beautiful. But certainly no graphics, no hieroglyphs, no reliefs in ancient Egypt in any place show them building pyramids or moving 1,000-ton blocks or anything like that. It's like they forgot to mention it. No, they didn't. They said that the sun gods built these things. And you find that in Southern America, in Southern in Central America, and in all the Americanos, society have these kind of remarkable things. You find it in China now, you find it in many different places. And so, what I'm saying is that and then you look at the symbols that were left in some of these buildings and in these traditions that were conveyed from all these traditions into the present. And, the symbols are very much reminiscent of some of the physics we're finding at the very advanced level of, either string theory or even, some of the new physics I'm talking about of the structure of space-time. So I think there is a message there that was left for us. And it's very important. It's encoded all around the world. And I think it was left for us by a very advanced civilization that no doubt had means more advanced than our current modern means. And I know it sounds dramatic and irrational to say so, but what I'm saying is based on straight up data. It's got nothing to do with some, archaeologist interpretation, but actually what it takes to do what is found.
It's fascinating that those voices in our head we talked about earlier, it's so easy in the field of physics, in the field of medicine, in fields of archaeology, to dismiss data that doesn't meet the model that you're trained mm-hmm. to think with. But real science is you find one thing that breaks your model is no longer perfectly accurate and it requires improvement. And when you find these things that cannot be archaeologically, medically, metaphysically, consciously, all you need is one that's provable, and you know there's more meat on the bone, and right. you've got to dig deeper. So my read on you is that you're one of those guys who looks for the things that just right. don't match, and says, well, that means you got to look yeah. more there. And I've traveled to some of those sites myself. I haven't been to Egypt, but I've been in South America. I've been in remote parts of Tibet. I've been even in remote parts of Scotland, mm-hmm. At very ancient ruins, 100,000 plus years old, with melted stone that cannot be melted unless you have advanced technologies. And look, all of those, all you need is one of those that's inexplicable. And you got to say, well, there's something we don't know. And then versus what we know is exactly the way it is.
You only add one, but there's thousands and thousands of those exactly. examples all around the world. So at one point, you have to reconsider. And, finally, archaeologists, at least Egyptologists in Egypt, are starting to reconsider. And more of them now are starting to say, okay, this doesn't make sense. Dynastic Egypt probably didn't build most of these, of these temples and structures. They probably were there prior to Dynastic Egypt, and then Dynastic Egypt claimed them, and they probably come from a more ancient source.
And what you're finding when you go to these sites is you're finding symbols that match advanced
right.
physics.
Well, symbols that match fundamental principles that are, that physics principles that are starting to become discovered. And the philosophy are, what we have, the remains philosophy of these theories that, match as well what we're describing, like the fact that everything is connected, the fact that there's a fundamental geometry at the source of creation that everything emerged from and returns to. All this is starting to become more and more evident, self-evident in physics. And basically, all of a sudden, something that's really ancient comes forward as like something that could be part of our future. And it's literally like a back to the future kind of thing. And it really, really says something deep about our history. And maybe even it says something deep about the existence of Homo sapiens on this planet, like in anthropology. It really is unclear how Homo sapiens emerged out of the natural order of things. You wouldn't expect that from linear Darwin evolution, that all of a sudden, an Homo sapien would emerge with all of a sudden much smaller stature, much more frail, much less capacity to survive, but all of a sudden double the size of the brain almost, and so on. So like there is like unclear, the so-called missing link might be, something we need to look at as well. And so it has deep implications.
Now, I've got to ask you, Watson and Crick admitted they were they had a dream and came out of it. And some of the great discoverers have gone back and used either advanced meditation, breathing, psychedelics. I'll just call it altered states work. Like the very highest performing minds are in an altered state, because if it was an average state, they wouldn't be high performing. So like I actually train altered states on myself and on others as a way to increase performance. They have to be the right altered states, otherwise they're right. pathological. But what's your practice for making your brain do what it does?
I don't know. I think I was born like that. I was fortunate enough. I mean, I fortunate in one sense, unfortunate in another, meaning my childhood was pretty difficult. I didn't fit in. I was really an outsider. I was very lonely, and it was hard for me. And as a result, my mother mostly looked for ways to, find ways to make me feel okay. And And one of those ways was to involve me in learning to meditate. And so at the age of 11, mm-hmm. I started to practice some meditation. And I think it really had a deep impact on me and on being able to quiet my mind enough that I could kind of capture a little better the information in the field that I could, like, it became more clear in some ways. I was tuning my antenna from early on, and I think it had a large impact as well. I discovered, and I was 11, I discovered rapidly that it became clear, oh, there's an internal world and an external world, because we tend to only think about the external world because that's what we interact with every day. But then I realized, wait, there's an internal world, right? And we can turn our senses inward. And then I remember thinking this very early on. I started to think maybe reality is the relationship of the internal world with the external world producing a standing wave that produced the reality we see around us. And that was the start of, this great adventure I've been on. And certainly I wasn't doing it to get a PhD or to get famous or to do anything like that. I was really just doing this by pure curiosity and wanting to understand reality. So I think it played a big role in maybe the way that my brain functions.
Well, one of these days, if I can get you in Seattle, I want to put 24-channel EEG on your brain and see what's going on.
Yeah,
there.
I'd love to.
Because, okay, we'll arrange that. I'm collecting brainwave patterns from very unusual and high-performance people so we can find the patterns and feed them into machine learning and actually tease out what are we doing to tune our antennas better. Because there's so much more capacity in most people than
that's a great idea.
I'll connect with you afterwards
for your experiment.
Beautiful. It'll take us a couple hours to get a good signal, and I'll tell you what we find too. We might find there's an alien in there wobbling around. Unlikely, but now, if someone came to you tomorrow, Nassim, and said, "Look, I want to perform better as a human being, like just at being human." What are the three most important pieces of advice you'd offer them just based on your life's path?
Okay. I would say awareness is critical. So take the time to become aware of yourself. You know, like awareness. Like so that the studies that are just coming out now showing that when you move your body without thinking about it, not actually much neural pathways are occurring in your brain, but when you actually move with intent, all of a sudden massive neural pathways are ignited in your brain. And so just having the awareness of what you're doing, like just realizing like the miracle you are in every second, like that, like, oh my God, it's an amazing thing that I'm able to move. I'm able to think. I'm able to be here, like to feel that gratitude, you know, in every moment is critical. So awareness, feeling of gratitude, you know, appreciation for even the tough stuff. Because if there's tough stuff, that means there's learning occurring. And if there's learning, there's growing, and it's wonderful. And then certainly on the third one would be to dedicate every day time to quiet down. You know, be by yourself, be alone, be within, and take that time, even if it's just 5 minutes a day, whatever modality you want to use. You know, it's I'm not professing that some meditation are better than other anything. Just anything that makes you turn your senses inward and find your center. Because from that place, if you're trying to improve your performance, that is where you want to be. Like when I used to teach skiing, you know, that was the most important part. It's like finding the state of equilibrium between all the alignments of your bones throughout the arc of a turn, right? That state of balance is in that center part of your being. And if you can just find that every day, even if it's for 5 minutes, then you can always go back to it if you start getting unstable during the day. And you know it's there. But if you don't know where it is, then you're pretty well left to all the chatter that's going on inside of you.
And then you'll see
exactly. Exactly. And then it hurts.
Now, you're doing some work with a Resonance Academy. Where can people find out what that is? Or maybe you can tell us what it is and where they can find out more information about
the work. Okay, well, the people can go to our website. It's called resonance.is. Resonance is. So Resonance is our main website, but there's the Resonance Academy that you can get to from our main website. And then you can take a course, which is great. You know, we have a 6-modular course that takes between 10 and 12 weeks for people to complete. And it connects you to a community of people. Thousands of people are taking it around the world. 80 countries are involved. And as a result, every month for 2 hours, you get to be with me on Zoom meetings, and we get to talk about things and answer questions, and all the students are there. And every year, then, the students that can come and meet physically in a beautiful place in the world. And this is why I was in Egypt for a month last month. It was the first, delegate gathering. And so this is a course people can get involved in. And it's great because you can study at your own pace. All the references are there. You can go as deep as you want or stay as light as you want. My kids did it. My friends' kids did it. And professional physicists have done it. And, it reaches everybody. And it's really a great way to participate in a global community and connect with people all around the world as well.
Beautiful. Well, thanks for being an original thinker, and thanks for coming on Bulletproof Radio. It's been a fascinating interview, and I'm grateful.
Thank you.
For
I appreciate having this opportunity to be on your show, and I look forward to the next time.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.